Goddard joined the movement to sterilize women deemed unfit. In the early 1900s, an Indiana prison surgeon named Harry Sharp performed vasectomies to stop men from transmitting defective germplasm. And in 1907, the Indiana legislature made sterilization a state policy. In New Jersey, Goddard lobbied for a similar bill, which Governor Woodrow Wilson signed in 1911. The first woman slated to be sterilized took her case to New Jersey's Supreme Court, which ruled it unconstitutional in 1913 as cruel and unusual punishment. Goddard responded to the defeat by redoubling his efforts. He joined new committees with ominous names, like the Committee for the Heredity of Feeble-Mindedness and the Committee to Study and to Report on the Best Practical Means of Cutting Off the Defective Germplasm in the American Population. There is no question that there should be a carefully worded sterilization law upon the statute book of every state, Goddard said. Lobbying governments and publishing reports would not be enough for Goddard. He wanted to win over public opinion. The heap of data he was collecting from hundreds of families would not make the country as a whole appreciate the threat of feeble-mindedness. He needed to find a parable to illustrate the destructiveness of feeble-mindedness through a single family. The choice was obvious. Emma Wolverton and her ancestors. Goddard began work on a book, his first. He used the school's notes about Emma to put together a short biography up to age 22. To protect her identity, he referred to her as Deborah Kallikak. Her last name was another one of Goddard's Greek creations, a combination of the words kalos, good, and kakos, bad. Yet he felt no compunction about adding photographs of Emma to the book. In one picture, she posed at her sewing machine. In another, she held a book open in her lap, her thick black hair kept neat in a bow. Casual readers might not see anything amiss with this young woman, but Goddard was quick to set them aright. Intelligence tests showed that she had a mental age of a 9-year-old. The question is, how do we account for this kind of individual? Goddard asked. The answer is in a word, heredity, bad stock. To prove his point, Goddard used Kite's research to tell the story of the Wolvertons. He started with John Wolverton, renaming him Martin Kallikak. Interspersed with the tales of drunks and horse thieves, Goddard's book included photographs Kite took of Emma's relatives. Old women and dirty children scowled at the camera, standing in front of sheds or sitting on sagging porches. Goddard also added family trees to the book, drooping with squares and circles, some of which were colored black to indicate feeble-mindedness. The defect flowed down through 6 generations of the trees, demonstrating the power of heredity. The story of the Kallikaks, Goddard concluded, was a powerful argument for rounding up the feeble-minded and putting them in colonies, at least until a better solution could be found. Sterilization might turn out to be that solution, but Goddard warned against simply operating on every member of feeble-minded families. To Goddard, his pedigree seemed to show that feeble-mindedness was a Mendelian trait, carried on a gene. If that was true, then it was entirely possible for a moron to have some children who were feeble-minded and others who were of normal intelligence. To sterilize them all would be like using a hatchet when a scalpel would do. The one thing that would not save the country from feeble-mindedness was naive hope. No amount of education or good environment can change a feeble-minded individual into a normal one, Goddard warned, any more than it can change a red-haired stock into a black-haired stock. In 1912, Goddard published The Kallikak Family. It gave a modern Mendelian polish to old beliefs about feeble-mindedness as a punishment for sin. The Evening Star, a Washington, D.C. newspaper, reprinted large excerpts from The Kallikak Family, accompanied by a shuddering commentary. I doubt if there is in all literature a more damning presentation of how one single sin can perpetuate itself in generations of untold misery and suffering to the end of time. The book became a bestseller, turning Goddard, a psychologist at a little-known backwoods institution, into one of the most famous scientists in the United States. His fame helped attract more attention to his imported intelligence tests. The New York City school system adopted them, administering them to all their students, and soon other school districts across the country followed suit. The United States Public Health Service reached out as well. They didn't need his help to teach students. Rather, they wanted to test the flood of immigrants arriving in the United States. Between 1890 and 1910, more than 12 million immigrants traveled from Europe to Ellis Island. Doctors inspected thousands of people arriving there each day to make sure they were in good physical health. In 1907, Congress passed a law to also exclude imbeciles, feeble-minded, and persons with physical or mental defects which might affect their ability to earn a living. The new law meant that the doctors on Ellis Island had to inspect the minds of immigrants as well as their bodies. Congress gave them no guidance, and so the Health Service asked Goddard if he could adapt his test to find the feeble-minded among the immigrants. "We were in fact most inadequately prepared for the task," Goddard later admitted. He knew that a test designed for American children might not work well on adults who didn't speak English or understand anything of American culture. But Goddard accepted the request, unwilling to pass up the opportunity, and created a new test for immigrants. Goddard brought his team of field workers to Ellis Island on a series of trips, starting in 1912. When ships docked and immigrants shuffled into the main building on the island, Goddard's field workers scanned them. They pointed out those who looked like they might be feeble-minded. The selected immigrants were pulled out of the crowd and taken to a side room. There, another field worker and an interpreter would give each immigrant a series of tasks, such as fitting blocks into holes or telling them what year it was. Goddard's staff kept careful records of the tests, which he analyzed back in Vineland. The results stunned him. A huge proportion of the immigrants tested as feeble-minded. Goddard broke down the results by ethnic group. 79% of Italians were feeble-minded, 83% of Jews, 87% of Russians. When Goddard published the figures, they were seized upon by opponents of immigration. For years, they had been claiming that the new wave of immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe was a burden to the country. More recently, they translated their bigotry into the language of eugenics. In 1910, Prescott Hall, a leader of the Immigration Restriction League, made the connection clear. "The same arguments which induce us to segregate criminals and feeble-minded and thus prevent their breeding," he said, "apply to excluding from our borders individuals whose multiplying here is likely to lower the average of our people." Goddard now handed them seemingly hard numbers, which they would use to justify slashing immigration quotas. Goddard himself was more suspicious of his own results. "They can hardly stand by themselves as valid," he said. "Immigrants might score badly on tests for all sorts of reasons. A Russian peasant might never get the chance to learn how to count. Calendars might be useless to him, as he worked on a farm." Goddard worked through the numbers again, using a more lenient cutoff for feeble-minded, and found that the fraction dropped by half. On reflection, Goddard seemed comfortable with the notion that 40% of immigrants were morons. "It is admitted on all sides that we are getting now the poorest of each race," he said. But Goddard didn't argue that any race was inherently less intelligent. He did suspect that some immigrants inherited their feeble-mindedness. "Morons beget morons," Goddard said. But poverty might be to blame for the low test scores of many other immigrants. If the latter, as seems likely, little fear may be felt for the children, Goddard said. Goddard's team was now overwhelmed with work. In addition to studying immigrants, he was continuing to analyze the data from hundreds of families that Kite and others had interviewed. Goddard was also training psychologists at Vineland in mental testing. But the work at the lab came almost entirely to a halt when the United States entered World War I and much of his staff enlisted. Goddard decided he could help the cause in his own way as well. He warned the Army that it might risk losing the war by unwittingly drafting hundreds of thousands of morons. The Army had Goddard and a group of his fellow intelligence experts draw up a test they could give to draftees. In 1917, he hosted a meeting at Vineland, where they adapted their tests to examine young men. The Army then hired 400 psychologists who administered the new tests to 1.7 million soldiers. It was an intelligence study thousands of times bigger than anything ever attempted before. "The knowledge derived from testing of the 1,700,000 men in the Army is probably the most valuable piece of information which mankind has ever acquired about itself," Goddard later declared. The soldiers followed the same swelling curve that Goddard had seen when he had tested New Jersey schoolchildren 6 years earlier. Most of the scores were close to the overall average, while a few soldiers scored exceptionally far above or below the rest. Goddard saw the Army results as a vindication of everything he had been saying about the biological nature of intelligence. Yet the average score of the soldiers was startlingly low. According to Goddard's standards, 47% of the white soldiers and 89% of the blacks should be categorized as morons. The average white soldier, the psychologists found, had a mental age of 13 years, just barely above the cutoff for feeble-mindedness. The majority of Americans, in other words, was feeble-minded, or close to it. When news of the results got out, it caused many Americans to look at their country with a new sense of self-loathing. "We have a working majority of voters who have children's minds," a prominent newspaper editor named William Allen White declared. White was convinced that the moron majority, as he dubbed it, must be a recent development. "A new biological condition faces us," he warned. The new immigrants from southern and eastern Europe lacked the mental grasp of the colonists who fought in the Revolution. "Our darker-skinned neighbors breed faster than we," he explained, "and their descendants inherited their feeble-mindedness. The plasm of the lame brain keeps right on producing lame brains," White concluded. To Goddard, the Army test results demanded a new form of government. Only about 4% of soldiers got an A on the test, meaning that they possessed very high intelligence. The top 4% of the country must be allowed to rule over the remaining 96. The fact that the United States was a democracy might make this arrangement hard to achieve, but Goddard believed that if the most intelligent came to understand how to make other Americans comfortable and happy, they would be elected to rule. "And then will come perfect government," Goddard declared in a 1919 lecture at Princeton. To put it another way, Goddard had decided that the entire country had to be turned into a giant Vineland training school. The children at the school had not voted to put Goddard and the rest of the administration in charge of their care, of course. But they would do so if given a chance, because they know that the one purpose of that group of officials is to make the children happy, Goddard said. Almost no one outside of Vineland knew that Emma Wolverton was Deborah Kallikak. But in the tiny world of the training school, everyone was aware, Emma included. Yet her local fame did not protect her from the brutal indifference of institutional life. 2 years after the publication of the Kallikak family, Johnstone summoned her to his office to tell her that she was going to have to leave. Rich children could stay for life at the Vineland Training School if their parents paid a one-time fee of $7,500. Poor children, whose care was paid for by the state of New Jersey, had to move out when they grew up. By the time they became adults, only a few of Vineland students could be trusted to live on their own. The rest needed to be moved elsewhere. Now, 25, Emma Wolverton walked back out the gate she had entered 17 years before. Garrison had died in 1900, and now his tomb stood at the corner just outside the gate. She stopped to thank him for her time there. "The training school," she whispered. "My home." Her trip was short. Emma was moved across Landis Avenue to the New Jersey State Institution for Feeble-Minded Women. Its mission was to keep its inmates from propagating their kind. Across the street, the institution staff also knew that Emma was the real Deborah Kallikak. While she might have been famous for her monstrous family, they found Emma capable and well-trained. She got to work with a dignified courtesy, according to a social worker there named Helen Reeves. She cared for the children of the institution staff, including that of the assistant supervisor. The children adored her and would send letters to her for the rest of her life. Emma also worked in the institution's hospital, even serving as a special nurse during an outbreak in the early 1920s. One day a patient bit one of her fingers so badly it had to be amputated. She sported the injury with pride. Emma discovered plays to perform in her new home as well. Once, when she played Pocahontas in a play at the institution, she had to throw herself on a dummy that represented Captain John Smith. "You could put more pep in it," the superintendent shouted during rehearsal. "If it were a real man, I would," she replied. Emma even managed to find a few real men. While she worked as a nurse during the epidemic, she moved into a room near the patients where she was under less monitoring. Using her skills at woodworking, she tinkered with the window screen so that she could slip in and out at night unnoticed. In the moonlight, she would meet a maintenance worker. They were eventually caught, and her suitor was kindly dismissed by a lenient justice of the peace, as Reeves later put it. Emma became involved with at least two other men, but each time the authorities broke it off. Only a few clues about those relationships survive. In 1925, the institution hired Emma out as a maid, but her service was cut short after less than a year. Over 30 years later, Emma met a psychology intern named Elizabeth Allen. Allen later recalled the stories told about Emma at the institution. Apparently, every time she was released to work on the outside, she would return pregnant, Allen wrote. If Emma did indeed become pregnant, there's no record of a child, an abortion, or sterilization. It isn't as if I'd done anything really wrong, Emma later complained. It was only nature. Only 4 years after Emma Wolverton was forced out of the Vineland Training School, Henry Goddard was forced out as well. Johnstone shut down Goddard's laboratory in 1918, but the documents that have survived don't offer many clues as to why things ended so badly. Writing to one of his funders, Goddard condemned the decision as a fatal error. Perhaps the parents of Goddard's subjects grew weary of him using them as psychological guinea pigs. Whatever the reason, Goddard abruptly left the Vineland School for Ohio. His celebrated work on eugenics and intelligence came to an end. In Ohio, he worked in relative obscurity, studying how to prevent juvenile delinquency and to help gifted children thrive. The Kallikak family had gained so much strength in the popular imagination that they no longer depended on Goddard. They endured without him. Paul Papineau, the editor of the Journal of Heredity, recounted their story as he lobbied for more states to sterilize the feeble-minded. "Such children should never be born," Papineau declared. "They are a burden to themselves, a burden to their family, a burden to the state, and a menace to civilization." In 1927, the Supreme Court heard a case about a young Virginia woman named Carrie Buck who had been scheduled for sterilization. The eugenicists submitted the Kallikak family as evidence that Buck's children would be doomed. The Supreme Court approved the state's petition, and Buck was sterilized. The court's decision led to a boom in sterilizations in the years that followed. In the 1920s, Goddard's work with the U.S. Army also continued to fuel scientific racism. Eugenicists pointed to the difference between black and white soldiers on the Army tests as proof of hereditary differences in intelligence between the races, and that the races should not be allowed to intermarry. The eugenicist Madison Grant declared that miscegenation was a social and racial crime of the first magnitude. American racism of the 1920s divided humanity into far thinner slices than just black and white, though. Eugenicists declared that Northern Europeans were superior to people from the rest of the continent. They pointed once more to Goddard's work on Ellis Island, as well as to the Army intelligence tests, on which immigrant Italians, Russians, and Jews did poorly. They also ignored the fact that these soldiers came from families that had only recently arrived in the United States. Harry Laughlin, who worked for Davenport at the Eugenics Record Office, testified to Congress that immigration threatened to pollute the American gene pool. "The lesson is that immigrants should be examined and the family stock should be investigated, lest we admit more degenerate blood," he said. In 1924, Congress tightened immigration with the passage of the National Origins Act, keeping out undesired races. The Kallikaks became celebrities far beyond America's shores as well. In 1914, Goddard's book was published in Germany to great acclaim. For years, many German doctors and biologists had been calling for a government-run program to breed the best parents, along with sterilization of the unfit. When Adolf Hitler was imprisoned in 1924, he learned of the Kallikaks in a book he read about heredity. Soon after, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, in which he mimicked the language of American eugenicists, declaring that sterilization of defective people is the most humane act of mankind. When Hitler came to power, an appalling number of German scientists and doctors heartily joined him in his campaign to alter humanity. The head of the German ethno-empire is the first statesman who has made the tenets of hereditary biology and eugenics a directing principle of state policy, declared the geneticist Otmar von Verschuer. In 1933, the year Hitler seized power, a new German edition of the Kallikak family was published. In his introduction, the translator, Karl Wilke, made clear just how important Goddard's work had been to the Nazis. Questions which were only cautiously touched upon by Henry Herbert Goddard at that time have resulted in the law for the prevention of sick or ill offspring, Wilke wrote. Just how significant the problem of genetic inheritance is, perhaps no example shows so clearly as the Kallikak family. The Nazis used the Kallikaks as a teaching tool. In 1935, the government released an educational film called Das Erbe. inheritance. It begins with two older male scientists explaining to their eager young female assistant about the laws of heredity. Over a montage of flowers and birds, of racehorses and hunting dogs, they talk about how to produce new breeds of animals and plants. A breeder's success depends on picking the right individuals to produce the next generation. The same is true for people. No better example of the harm of poorly planned families is the Kallikak family. The work of American eugenicist Henry Goddard, one of the German scientists says. The screen turns black, and a title appears across the top. The Descendants of Lieutenant Kallikak. The lieutenant is marked by a circle from which springs downward branches, 493 superior offspring from a woman of healthy stock, along with 434 inferior offspring from a woman with a hereditary disease. A single ancestor with hereditary disease was enough to leave a large number of unfortunate descendants, one of the scientists explains. This is just one example among thousands. Sympathy for the suffering of such people required preventing them from reproducing, by all means. After the pedigree appears in full, it is replaced on the screen by a quotation from Hitler. "He who is not healthy and dignified in spirit cannot perpetuate his suffering in the body of his child." In the same year that Das Erbe was released, the Nazis put on the Exhibition for Hereditary Care, where visitors could look at exhibits on the many disabilities that needed to be eradicated. A doctor got into a conversation with a skeptical visitor. To persuade him of the importance of eugenics, the doctor recounted the story of the Kallikaks. "This examination was initiated and directed by the American Professor Goddard," the doctor assured the visitor. "There is even a book about it." The visitor was persuaded, asking the doctor if all the cripples and idiots shown at the exhibition were due to the same cause. "Yes," the doctor replied. "There is only one answer: heredity." Hitler followed up on this propaganda by establishing a new set of racial hygiene laws. Hereditary health courts accepted applications from doctors for people who were so unfit they should not be allowed to have children. The feeble-minded made up the majority of the approvals. Psychiatrists devised intelligence tests for the courts. In one exam, they gave subjects a suitcase, books, bottles, and other objects. They had to pack the suitcase so that the lid could be easily closed. Their lives might depend on that suitcase. Within a year of the passage of the first racial hygiene law, the hereditary health courts approved more than 64,000 sterilizations. And by 1944, Germany sterilized at least 400,000 people, including the mentally ill, the deaf, gypsies, and Jews. In 1939, Hitler expanded his campaign against the feeble-minded, launching a program to kill children judged to be idiots, along with those suffering deformities. Their parents were told that they had died during surgery or due to an accidental overdose of sedatives. Soon, children were being killed for being teenage delinquents or just for being Jewish. Hitler then added yet another program to kill adults who were institutionalized for feeble-mindedness or other defects. Before extermination, children would be asked questions that wouldn't have been out of place in Vineland, such as, "Can you name the four seasons?" The program, known as T4, would ultimately claim 200,000 lives. It operated on a scale so far beyond what the Nazis had attempted before that they had to invent new technology for the slaughter, including gas chambers. McKim's eugenic dream had become real. A few people saw straight through the Kallikak story right away. In 1922, the journalist and political commentator Walter Lippmann delivered an attack in the New Republic. He granted that Binet's original tests had some value as a way to identify children in need of special education. But since then, in the hands of people like Goddard, they had been used to promote monstrous distortions. The statement that the average mental age of Americans is only about 14 is not inaccurate. It is not incorrect. It is nonsense, he wrote. It was nonsense, Lippmann declared, to treat intelligence as something as straightforward as height or weight, when psychologists had yet to actually define it. Until that day, intelligence would remain simply the thing that intelligence tests measure. But those tests were constantly in flux, as their designers adjusted their thresholds to produce results that satisfied their expectations. To conclude from these tests, then, that intelligence was a hereditary trait was downright pernicious. Obviously, this is not a conclusion obtained by research, Lippman declared. It is a conclusion planted by the will to believe. To reach that conclusion, testing advocates had to ignore all sorts of experiences that could influence the scores, especially those in early childhood when the brain is still developing, and they had to embrace stories like that of the Kallikaks without any healthy skepticism. In fact, Lippman warned, there was some doubt as to the Kallikaks. Even if the story was true, it wouldn't be as compelling an experiment as Goddard claimed. To see how powerful heredity really was, it would have been necessary for Martin Kallikak to have fathered an illegitimate child with a healthy but poor woman. Likewise, his respectable marriage would need to be with a feeble-minded woman from a prosperous family. Then only would it have been possible to say with complete confidence that this was a pure case of biological rather than of social heredity, Lippman said. Some scientists questioned the Kallikak story as well. In 1925, a Boston neurologist named Abraham Meyerson mocked the lurid tale of Martin Kallikak's disastrous dalliance with a feeble-minded girl, after which he used his germplasm in orthodox fashion by marrying a nice girl who bore him nice children and started a row of nice people, all nice, no immoral, no syphilitics, no alcoholics, no insane, no criminals. Meyerson found it ridiculous that Goddard thought he could diagnose generations of Kallikaks based on the stories collected by Elizabeth Kite. I cannot get any definite information about my great-great-grandfather, much as I have tried, Meyerson joked. But a girl who left so little impression on her times as to be nameless is positively declared to be feeble-minded. Perhaps the most important opponent of the Kallikaks was a biologist who spent much of his time in a lab full of milk bottles packed with rotting bananas. Thomas Hunt Morgan didn't know much about psychology, and yet his attack on the Kallikak family was the most profound of all. More than anyone, he could see how weak the foundations were on which Goddard built his story. Morgan kept rotting bananas in his lab at Columbia University in New York City in order to feed a species of fly called Drosophila melanogaster. He had begun studying them in 1907, hoping to catch one of DeVries's species-creating mutations. But Morgan came to realize that no single mutation could create a new species. It could give rise to a new trait, however. One day, Morgan and his colleagues spotted a male fly that grew white eyes instead of the normal red. The scientists put the white-eyed male together with a red-eyed female, and the insects mated. The female then produced healthy eggs, which developed into red-eyed offspring. Morgan's team then bred those flies with each other, and found that in the following generation, some of the male insects had white eyes. It was puzzling that only males could inherit white eyes, but could not pass them down to their own sons. In search of an explanation, Morgan and his colleagues made a major discovery about the nature of genes. Morgan's flies, like all animals, had chromosomes in their cells. Chromosomes usually came in identical pairs, with one exception, a mismatched set of chromosomes that came to be known as X and Y. Studying insect cells, scientists discovered that males carried one X and one Y, while females carried two X's. This discovery raised the possibility that the X and Y chromosomes carried hereditary factors, what came to be known as genes, that determined which sex an insect would be. The fact that Morgan's male flies could develop white eyes might mean that a gene located on the X or Y chromosomes determined eye color. After many experiments with the flies, Morgan's team figured out that this was indeed the case. White eyes are produced by a recessive mutation on a gene located on the X chromosome. Females with one copy of the white eye mutation can have red eyes anyway, because their other X chromosome is normal. But since males have only one X chromosome, they can't compensate for the mutation and develop white eyes. Further experiments in Morgan's lab revealed that the sex chromosomes could also carry mutations to other traits, such as one that turns the bodies of flies yellow or shrinks their wings. It became clear from experiments like these that chromosomes carried genes, and that a single chromosome could carry many of them. As Morgan's team pinned down the location of more genes, they came to realize that heredity was a lot more complicated than scientists had previously thought. When Mendel's work was initially rediscovered, many geneticists assumed that each trait was controlled by a single gene. Morgan's team found that many genes could influence a single trait. For example, they identified 25 different genes that could change the color of a fly's eyes. It is of the utmost importance that this hypothesis be understood, the Journal of Heredity declared when Morgan published some of his findings in 1915. If genes worked in such an intricate way in flies, the story in humans had to be far more complex. Those who accept it must give up talking about, e.g., Roman nose being due to a determiner for Roman nose in the germplasm. The modern view would say that the Romanness of the nose is due to the interaction of a very large number of factors. Early in his career, Morgan had started out on good terms with Charles Davenport and other American eugenicists, but he was appalled to see how desperately they clung to a Roman nose view of heredity, even as the evidence piled up against it. In a 1925 book, Morgan spelled out all that was wrong with their approach to human nature. It was true that individual genes might play a small part in explaining behavior, Morgan granted. Davenport and other scientists had gathered compelling evidence that a single dominant mutation caused Huntington's disease, for example. But Morgan doubted Goddard's claim that something as amorphous as feeble-mindedness could have such a simple hereditary explanation. It is extravagant to pretend to claim that there is a single Mendelian factor for this condition, Morgan wrote. Morgan didn't think it would be possible to really begin to study the heredity of feeble-mindedness until scientists decided what they actually mean by intelligence itself. In reality, our ideas are very vague on the subject, he wrote. Scientists would also have to give more credit to the ways in which the environment influenced the human mind. In Morgan's own research on flies, he had learned to respect the power of the environment. His students discovered one strain of flies that developed normally if they were born in the summer, but tended to sprout extra legs if they were born in the winter. It turned out that the researchers could get the same outcomes in their lab simply by changing the temperature in which they reared the fly eggs. It was thus meaningless to talk about the effect of their mutation without taking into account their environment. When Morgan looked at the pedigrees of families like the Kallikaks, he did not see undeniable proof of the heredity of feeble-mindedness. He saw instead many generations of poor people suffering enduring hardships. It is obvious that these groups of individuals have lived under demoralizing social conditions that might swamp a family of average persons, Morgan wrote. The effects may to a large extent be communicated rather than inherited. If that was true, Morgan argued, it was patently ridiculous to turn to eugenics to try to improve humanity's lot. The student of human heredity will do well to recommend more enlightenment on the social causes of deficiencies, he concluded. By the 1930s, many other geneticists had followed Morgan's example and repudiated eugenics as both bad science and bad policy. The Eugenics Record Office, the hub of research and social policy based on human heredity, sank into disrepute. In his testimony to Congress, Harry Laughlin offered statistics that supposedly showed the intellectual superiority of Northern Europeans. They turned out to be full of glaring errors. The Carnegie Institution, which gave much of the money to run the Eugenics Record Office, realized that its field workers had been gathering sloppy, subjective data that would be useless for scientific research. Even the organization of the files turned out to be a futile system. The office was shut down in 1939, having been judged a worthless endeavor from top to bottom. American eugenicists lost more followers as they cozied up to the Nazi government, pleased to see their policies put so aggressively into action. Laughlin even traveled to Germany to accept an honorary degree. Once the full scope of the Holocaust emerged, the eugenics of people like Laughlin and Davenport would never be able to separate itself from genocide. The Kallikak family finally went out of print in 1939. By then, it had worked its way into psychology textbooks, where it could terrify college students. A psychologist named Knight Dunlap complained of having to talk one of his students out of committing suicide for fear of having inherited a mental defect from her family. Fortunately, as he later recalled, he was able to ease her anxiety by promising that her chances of going insane were no better than my own. In 1940, Dunlap published a blistering attack on the Kallikak family in the journal Scientific Monthly. Even in books written by psychologists who ought to know better, the Kallikaks skulk in the corners of the pages and leap out upon unwary students. In 1944, a doctor named Amram Scheinfeld published a harsh memorial to mark the 30th anniversary of the Kallikak family. Writing in the Journal of Heredity, Scheinfeld scoffed at the idea that a single mutant gene could have worked its way through one branch of the Kallikak family, causing feeble-mindedness and other attendant ills along the way. He skewered Goddard for ignoring the possibility that what he thought was inherited behavior was the result of growing up in grinding poverty. The only reason that the Kallikak study had become so well known, Scheinfeld said, was because it would permit those on top to smugly keep their place while relieving them of the necessity of doing very much for those at the bottom. And its legacy had been dreadful, not just for genetics, but for human society in general. The idea at the core of the Kallikak family, that some people were genetically superior to others, Scheinfeld said, helped to bring on the present war. These attacks, Dunlap, for example, declaring that the Kallikak fantasy has been laughed out of psychology, galled Goddard. The rising generation of psychologists were creating a caricature of him and his ideas. In the years after he was forced out of Vineland, Goddard drifted away from the eugenics movement. Rather than figuring out how to keep the feeble-minded from having children, Goddard spent his time trying to find ways to help children, no matter their condition. "As for myself," Goddard once said, "I think I have gone over to the enemy." In truth, Goddard moved only a bit closer to the enemy. In 1931, he traveled from Ohio back to Vineland to speak at a meeting celebrating the 25th anniversary of the research laboratory. As he spoke, it became clear that Morgan's genetics lessons had not sunk in. Goddard granted that perhaps feeble-mindedness depended on more than one gene, but he still believed it was overwhelmingly hereditary. Sterilizing a feeble-minded woman would very likely prevent the birth of more feeble-minded babies. The Great Depression was reaching its depths when Goddard came back to Vineland, and he blamed it largely on America's lack of intelligence. Most of the newly destitute didn't have the foresight to save enough money. "Half of the world must take care of the other half," Goddard said. Goddard also defended the data he had collected at Vineland against the growing number of critics. "No one has shown where the Vineland figures are in error," he declared in his 1931 speech. But privately, Goddard had an inkling that something was wrong. The attacks on the Kallikak family led him to write to Elizabeth Kite about her fieldwork. Kite confessed that she had never bothered to find out the name of the girl in the tavern. Her excuse for this lapse was that discovering the tawdry origin of the feeble-minded Kallikak line had left her stunned. "That was all I could stand for one day," Kite told Goddard. In 1942, when Goddard published a defense of the Kallikak research, he lied about Kite's lapse. He said that he knew the woman's name, but had withheld it for the sake of privacy. The only flaw Goddard could see in his work was that it was ahead of its time. "Much in the way of polish is lacking in this pioneer study," he said. That marked the end of Goddard's attempts to salvage his reputation. Soon afterward, he retired from Ohio State University and published a guide to parenting called Our Children in the Atomic Age. He thought about writing an autobiography, but he only got as far as a decidedly un-eugenic title, As Luck Would Have It. In 1957, Goddard died at age 90. In their obituary, the Associated Press remembered him for two accomplishments, coining the word moron and discovering the Kallikaks. The author's conclusion was that the Kallikak family presents a natural experiment in heredity, the obituary writer reported. Later, some other psychologists cast some doubt on his deductions. Even after Goddard's death, the Kallikak family lived on. Henry Garrett, a psychologist at Columbia University who served for a time as president of the American Psychological Association, would retell the story for decades. In 1955, he published a textbook called General Psychology that included a full-page illustration of the Kallikak genealogy. Martin Kallikak stands like a towering colonial colossus. His arms are akimbo, and the left half of his body shaded. Down his left side spills a cascade of demonic faces. "He dallied with a feeble-minded tavern girl," Garrett wrote alongside the illustration. "She bore a son known as Old Horror, who had 10 children. From Old Horror's 10 children came hundreds of the lowest types of human beings. Their hair was swept back like demon horns." On his right side, Kallikak was white, flanked by tranquil faces of men and women in proper hats. "He married a worthy Quakeress," Garrett wrote. "She bore 7 upright, worthy children. From these seven worthy children came hundreds of the highest types of human beings. The textbook would go through many editions, and students would still be looking at the Kallikak family in the 1960s. In 1973, the year of his death, Garrett railed against the constitutional right to vote, complaining how the vote of the feeble-minded person counts as much as that of an intelligent man. In the 1980s, curious investigators uncovered Deborah Kallikak's real name. A pair of genealogists, David McDonald and Nancy McAdams, worked back through Goddard's account, determining the true identity of Emma Wolverton's relatives. In the process, every piece of Goddard's book, the founding testimony of modern eugenics and an inspiration for one of the greatest crimes in history, simply vanished. It turned out that Elizabeth Kite had misunderstood an old woman she interviewed in 1910. Kite got the impression that a soldier named John Wolverton had a bastard son named John Wolverton. In fact, the two John Wolvertons were second cousins. In other words, Goddard's natural experiment in heredity never happened. The bad branch of the Wolverton clan turned out not to be a horde of feeble-minded monsters. John Wolverton, whom Goddard called Martin Old Horror Kallikak, was not an unwashed drunk who rolled off porches after too much cider. Public records show he was a landowner, and that he eventually transferred his property to his children and grandchildren. The 1850 census indicates that he lived with his daughter and her children, all of whom could read. Just before his death in 1861, his property was valued at the respectable sum of $100. Old Horror's descendants didn't match Goddard's grotesque portraits either. Their ranks included bank treasurers, policemen, coopers, Civil War soldiers, school teachers, and a pilot in the Army Air Corps. Emma happened to have the bad luck to be born into a Wolverton family that was ripped apart in the great migration of American farmers into cities in the late 1800s. Her maternal grandparents moved to the outskirts of Trenton, where her grandfather worked as a laborer. There were 11 children in the family, six of whom died young. Life for the remaining five was hard, and at times unbearable. Emma's grandfather appears to have been a menace to his children, who were all removed from the household. Emma's Aunt Mary visited her parents in 1882 at age 12. Her father attacked her, and she gave birth to a child, who soon died. Emma's grandfather was prosecuted for incest a few months later, but there's no record that he served time in prison. Despite growing up in a poor, uneducated, violent family, Emma's relatives endured. Emma's Aunt Mary returned to her foster family for the rest of her childhood, and later in life she got married. Emma's Uncle George, whom Goddard described as a feeble-minded horse thief, actually made a living as a farmhand and was a member of the Salvation Army. Emma's Uncle John held jobs as a mill worker and rubber worker in Trenton. Even Emma's mother, Melinda, eventually found a stable life. After she married her second husband, Louis Danbury, in 1897, they stayed together for 35 years, until her death in 1932. Louis was later buried next to her. Emma's half-brothers and sisters, dismissed by Goddard as feeble-minded, were nothing of the sort. Fred Wolverton fought in World War I and worked as a car mechanic. One of Emma's nephews became a career army man, while another worked as a golf pro. By the time Emma Wolverton's true history came to light, she had been dead for years, buried on the institution's grounds. She had lived there for 53 years. In her later years, she worked in the institution's gymnasium, producing plays performed by the inmates. Emma would sew the costumes and build the sets. She filled her spare time reading books and magazines, or wrote letters to friends. She even left the institution from time to time, accompanying the staff on outings. She wandered among the dinosaurs at the American Museum of Natural History and fed bits of bread to the squirrels in Central Park. In 1957, the year that Goddard died, Emma met the intern Elizabeth Allen. Emma was tall and reticent, Allen later recalled. She reminded me of anyone's elderly aunt. Emma was 68. She had stopped producing plays, but she still worked, ironing institution uniforms. A space at the institution was converted into a tiny apartment where she could live by herself. Allen was shocked when Emma told her that she was Deborah Kallikak. The story of the Kallikaks was well known to all psychologists in the 1950s, and Allen found it hard to believe Emma was the dangerous moron of Goddard's description. "I found her to be informative and interesting to talk with," Allen said. "She was considerate and personable, and certainly not what I would think of as a retarded person. It was said that her judgment was not fully developed, understandable for someone practically raised in an institution. In later years, Emma developed arthritis. She stopped sewing and woodworking. Instead of writing letters, she dictated them. But even in her 80s, confined to a wheelchair, she still sang songs from the plays she had performed in. I'm a gypsy, I'm a gypsy, oh, I am a little gypsy girl. The forest is my home, and there I love to roam, for I am a little gypsy girl. She never did roam. Capable as Emma proved herself over the decades of hard work, she came to believe that she deserved to remain, in effect, a prisoner. I guess after all, I'm where I belong, she told Helen Reeves. I don't like this feeble-minded part, but anyhow, I'm not idiotic like some of the poor things you see around here. In her old age, she was offered the chance to leave the institution, but declined. She lived out her days there, dying at age 89 in 1978. She was buried on the institution grounds. After Emma had left the Vineland Training School, she never saw Goddard again. But she once told Reeves that she had named one of the cats, Henry, for a dear, wonderful friend who wrote a book. It's the book what made me famous. She was devoted to the people who conducted the study, as though they were her family, Alan recalled. When Goddard sent Emma a Christmas card in 1946, Reeves wrote back to him to let him know how happy Emma was to receive it. The nicest thing about it, Emma told Reeves, is that he thought I have the brains to understand it, which of course I do. Chapter 4. At a Girl. 9 years before she enrolled her daughter at the Vineland Training School, Pearl Buck woke up out of an ether sleep and saw a bloom of plum blossoms on the table by her bed. She turned her head to see a nurse holding her newborn baby in a pink blanket. Pearl looked into the girl's eyes. "Doesn't she look very wise for her age?" she asked the nurse. It was a warm day in March 1920. Pearl Buck was 28, an American-born teacher living in northern China. She had grown up in China, her missionary parents having brought her there as a baby. After 4 years of college in the United States, she returned to care for her ailing mother. Soon afterward, she met an expat agricultural expert named John Lossing Buck, whom she married in 1917. For the first 3 years of their marriage, they lived in a remote town called Nansuxiao. From the windows of the house, she could see miles of flat farmland. Over the green wheat, mirages of lakes and mountains flirted with her eyes. She and Lossing named their girl Caroline. Carol, as she quickly came to be known, was a fair-haired, blue-eyed baby. A few things caught Pearl's attention, but she didn't give them much mind. Carol had eczema that made her scratch. Her skin gave off a peculiar, musty smell. Pearl had more important things to worry about. A few weeks after Carol's birth, Pearl's doctor told her that she had a tumor in her uterus. She took the long journey back to the United States to have it surgically removed. The tumor proved to be benign, but her American doctors informed Pearl she would be unable to have any more children. The Bucks moved from Nansuxiao to the city of Nanking, where Lossing got a job teaching agriculture at the university. Pearl taught English while Carol played in the gardens and bamboo groves surrounding their house. As Carol grew, Pearl began to worry. The babies of her friends were beginning to walk. Carol still crawled. They began to speak. Carol babbled. Her eczema grew so bad that Pearl would sometimes put bandages on her hands so that she wouldn't rake her skin. Pearl kept her worries to herself, partly out of shame and partly out of her knowledge that her family would have little sympathy. Pearl's father was a rigid fundamentalist who cared only about tallying up the souls he saved. Her mother, suffering from a lethal digestive disorder called sprue, had abandoned Christianity as she waited to die. And Lossing, Pearl discovered after they got married, was a hollow man. He has never seen or understood anything, she would later say. Carol eventually learned to walk, but she still wasn't learning to talk. She was big for her age, restless and demanding, making her desires known with jabbering and grunts. She sniffed at visitors and jumped up on them as a friendly dog would. The things that made other children laugh or cry drew only a blank stare from Carol. Pearl's friends assured her that everything was fine, that children begin speaking at different ages. Years later, they would confess to Pearl that they shrank from speaking the truth. They knew something was wrong. That summer, Pearl took Carol to the seashore to play on the beach and ride donkeys through the nearby valleys. She even managed to teach Carol to speak a few words. One day that summer, Pearl went to a lecture by a local pediatrician about the health of young children. The pediatrician described some warning signs of psychological disorders, such as incessantly running around, and it sounded to Pearl as if she was talking about Carol. The next day, the pediatrician paid Pearl a visit with some other doctors. Examining Carol, they could tell that something was indeed wrong, but they couldn't say what. For a firm diagnosis, Pearl would need to take Carol to the United States. The Bucks already had a trip back home in the works so that Lossing could pursue a master's degree at Cornell. He and Pearl settled into a cramped two-room apartment in Ithaca, New York, and from time to time, Pearl would take Carol around the country to see doctors, psychologists, pediatricians, gland specialists. They all told her something was wrong, but none could give her a diagnosis. Yet she always left the exams with an unfocused hope that Carol would get better. Pearl's last trip took her to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. There, a young doctor gently broke the news to her. Carol had stopped developing mentally. "Is it hopeless?" Pearl asked him. "I think I would not give up trying," the doctor said. Pearl and Carol walked out of the doctor's office and made their way down an empty hall. A small, bespectacled doctor with a clipped black mustache emerged from a room, and he asked in a crisp German accent if the other doctor had said Carol could be cured. Pearl said he didn't rule it out. "She will never be well. Do you hear me?" the second doctor said. "Find a place where she can be happy and leave her there and live your own life." Pearl staggered out of the clinic. Carol, happy to be done with the strangers, danced ahead. When she noticed that her mother had started to cry, Carol laughed. For the rest of her time in the United States, Pearl struggled to make the best of her life. She earned a master's degree of her own in English and wrote a few articles about China. To most Americans in the 1920s, the country was an alien giant, and so editors were happy to publish stories from someone with such deep knowledge of the place. Pearl discovered that she enjoyed writing and that she was good at it. Before returning to China, she and Lossing visited a New York orphanage and adopted a 3-month-old girl they named Janice. Back in China, Pearl became overwhelmed by sadness over Carol. She couldn't even bear to listen to music. When guests came to the house, she would put on a brave face, but as soon as they left, she would let her sorrow have its way. Pearl began writing stories along with her essays, imagining the lives of Chinese people around her. Carol would become intensely jealous as Pearl became absorbed in her work. She threw porridge at her mother and used handfuls of potting soil to clog the keys of Pearl's typewriter. While the Bucks had been away, China had grown far more dangerous. The Kuomintang and its enemies had begun battling for control of different pieces of the country. For 2 years, the fighting remained far from Nanking, but in 1927 it reached the city. As foreigners were shot and raped, the Bucks hid in the hut of a Chinese woman Pearl knew. Pearl kept Carol and Janice quiet so that they wouldn't draw the attention of nearby soldiers. She vowed to herself to kill her girls before letting the soldiers take them away. The attacks subsided after American and British gunships arrived in Nanking and fired on the city. The Bucks took the opportunity to flee, making their way to Shanghai. Shanghai proved only a brief stopover for them. The fighting drove the Bucks out of China altogether. They ended up in Japan, surviving in a remote forest cabin for months on fish, fruit, and rice. Once China settled down again into a relative calm, the Bucks returned. Pearl now became painfully aware of how the children of her friends were developing and thriving, while Carol, now 8, still acted like a toddler. When she tried to teach Carol to write, her daughter managed to learn only a few words. During one of their lessons, Pearl took the pencil from Carol and was startled to discover that her daughter's hand was drenched in sweat from all her effort. Pearl was ashamed that she had made Carol so miserable and decided to stop forcing her to try to become like other girls. As her mother, Pearl would only try to make Carol happy. "I realized I must leave her in some place," Pearl later recalled, "and my heart is wrenched in two at the thought." Aside from the dread of separation, Pearl also recognized that she faced some grim economics. Lossing thought Carol should go to a state institution. The idea terrified Pearl, but she knew they didn't have the money to pay for a private school. Pearl realized she would have to find the funds on her own. "I had found out enough to know that the sort of place I wanted my child to live in would cost money that I did not have," she later wrote. Her income from teaching was meager, and she made even less from writing articles for American magazines. She wondered if fiction might pay better. By then, she had finished her first novel, which she called East Wind, West Wind. She got an idea for a second novel that might sell well. Whenever she found a free 10 minutes between chores or caring for Carol, she would sit down to her typewriter and write about the adventures of a Chinese farmer she named Wang Lung. In 1929, the Bucks traveled back to the United States. As Lossing negotiated a new grant for his work on Chinese agriculture, Pearl searched for a place where Carol could live. Many of the visits left her chilled. At one institution, the children were clothed in burlap and herded like dogs. Eventually, Pearl ended up in southern New Jersey, at a farm where the children seemed happy. "I saw children playing around the yards behind the cottages, making mud pies and behaving as though they were at home," she later recalled. "I saw a certain motto repeated again and again on the walls, on the stationery, hanging above the head's own desk. It was this: happiness first, and all else follows." In September 1929, Pearl Buck enrolled her daughter at the Vineland Training School. Emma Wolverton had been taken out of the school 15 years earlier, and a decade had passed since Henry Goddard had left. The enthusiasm for eugenics had left the place as well. In the 1920s, Vineland psychologists did important research on classifying different forms of feeble-mindedness, what are now known as intellectual developmental disorders. They created a test to track the social development of children that's known today as the Vineland Social Maturity Scale. Pearl stayed with friends for a month while Carol settled in at the school. It was the first time they had been separated in her life, and for Pearl it was torture. She listened for her daughter's calls for help in the night, her steps on the stairs. "Only the thought of a future with the child grown old and me gone kept me from hurrying to the railway station," she said. Pearl went to New York to show the manuscript for East Wind, West Wind to a publisher named Richard Walsh. He bought it, along with a new novel she was in the midst of writing. When she and Lossing returned to China in 1930, she worked on nothing else, losing herself in the story of Wang Lung to keep her pain at bay. When she sent the book to Walsh, he gave her a name for it: The Good Earth. Pearl's gritty story about a poor Chinese hero was an unfamiliar one to American readers. If they had read any fiction from China, it was classical tales about the country's elite. The Good Earth, published in the midst of America's Great Depression, felt like an Asian parallel to The Grapes of Wrath. In 1932, it earned Pearl the Pulitzer Prize, and it also proved a smashing commercial success. In just the first 18 months after publication, Buck earned $100,000, and the book would earn hundreds of thousands more during her lifetime. Pearl had only wanted to pay for a home for Carol. Instead, she became a celebrity. In quick succession, Pearl moved back to the United States, got a Nevada divorce from Lossing, married Walsh, bought a farm in Pennsylvania, and adopted more children. Hollywood turned The Good Earth into a box office hit, while Pearl found herself in fierce demand for lectures around the country. Pearl made savvy use of her new fame to champion political causes, especially civil rights. Growing up in China, she became keenly aware of the contempt some Chinese had for her simply because she was white. When she returned to the United States, she scoffed at the idea that the country's blacks and whites were biologically distinct in any meaningful way, calling humanity a creature hopelessly mongrel in 1938, just 7 years after publishing The Good Earth in the hope of taking care of Carol. Pearl S. Buck won the Nobel Prize in Literature. When she got the news, she responded in Chinese, "Wo pu shang xin," "I don't believe it." The more stories that Pearl told, the more the world clamored to hear her own. But she refused to reveal Carol's secret. "It is not a shame at all, but something private and sacred, as sorrow must be," Pearl wrote to a friend. When reporters asked about her family, she would say she had two daughters, one of whom was away at school. An old friend from Nanking was interviewed by an Ohio newspaper and recalled Pearl's suffering over Carol. Pearl got wind of the story and arranged to have it quashed. She wanted to protect Carol, but herself as well. "I would gladly have written nothing if I could have just an average child in Carol," she once said. From the profits on The Good Earth, Pearl gave the Vineland School $40,000, guaranteeing Carol a lifetime of care. Pearl later paid for the construction of a new two-story cottage where Carol could live with 15 other girls, complete with a French provincial bedroom set, a phonograph, and a collection of records. Carol liked hymns, hated jazz. Once Pearl returned to the United States, she would visit Carol as often as she could, sometimes as often as once a week, and sometimes brought her back to her farm in Pennsylvania for a few days. Pearl thus got to watch Carol grow up. She began to bathe and dress herself, even to tie her shoelaces. She learned to eat with a fork and spoon, to sew, and to use words to tell others what she needed. She roller skated. She loved to ride a tricycle.